So, excellent. Here we go.
Sweet.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's Austrian Wine Time Masterclass with Jen Cooks. My name is Antoinette Londejan from Cork and Fork in Washington, D.C. We are a premium wine store founded by a multi-generational flying winemaker originally from Champagne, France. I am delighted to introduce today's presenter, S. Pratch. From an early age, Stefan's path to winemaking was clear, and after he moved to taking over his family winery, he applied all of the information he learned during his theoretical education at the viticultural school in Mistelbach, and where he got to know the practice that he then applied to his parents' traditional business. It was a time to find the perfect way, which he applied, using the character of the soil to reflect the grapes grown on it. By refusing to use any animal products in the winery, Stefan ensures that his whole range is vegan friendly. Instead of using agents like gelatin, he uses pea and potato starch as stabilizing agents. Stefan is represented this evening by internationally acclaimed consulting winemaker and winery developer, Jen Cooks. For those joining us live, we'd love to hear from you. Place your questions in the Q&A and we will get to them time allowing. Since our guest is joining us live from Europe, quite a few hours ahead of us here in the United States, we will move immediately into the presentation. Jan, please introduce yourself and this beautiful winery.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks, Antoinette. Yes, as mentioned, I represent Stefan. I've been working now with Stefan for roughly 14 years now. I help and develop wineries, develop their international sales and their international portfolios. And I'm very, very well connected to the winery now. We're very well connected over to the winery now over the last 14 years. So, I'm very honored to be here. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your interest. I hope this is going to be worth your while and very, very interesting. So I'll just get cracking. This is Stefan. So today he's 34 years old. So I met him when he was 20 years old, at a time where their production was very small. He actually started winemaking when he was 14. So he basically just went to his dad and said, "Look, our company's set up with agriculture, with normal viticulture, and with livestock. And it's really my big wish. I would like to make something more out of the whole viticultural part and develop that." So that's pretty much where they went off, sold off the livestock, took the stables, refurbished them, put some tanks in, and that's where it basically started. Then over the next couple of years, he received a couple of awards and became a little bit more, let's say, yeah, put his head up above the clouds. And we got together and started working pretty much. So it's been a very, very successful enterprise so far. Stefan works today in 14 different countries outside of Austria. And he's won multiple awards, multiple international and national awards. I think one of the most outstanding awards is that in 2013, he was awarded Best Grand Cru of Austria. So that meant in the coming year, the entire top scene of gastronomists came to him and asked him for some wine, and he basically could just give them, like, you know, six bottles each or 12 bottles each. That was it. So there are many reasons for this. This did not come overnight, of course, as you can imagine, as most things don't. One of the most important factors in the whole thing is Stefan's dad, Willy, who started with organics, started, let's say, experimenting with organics in the late 80s, 1980s. And then by 1990 had certified the entire property. So agriculture and viticulture, certified organic. Now, the reason for that is it's pretty simple. I hope you can see you can see my mouse. So here's Vienna. Here's the main hub, the capital. Stefan is located right about halfway between Vienna and the border. So right about here. If you take a look at the entire topography of Austria, you have pretty much here is where mountains start. So all of this whole entire region is mountainous. All of this way north is our flat rolling hills. So with a predominant wind coming from the northeast, so basically from Poland, coming down from Poland and Russia, so predominantly cold wind. Austria has three predominant wind directions. So the northeast, of course, everything comes in from the northeast. The west, like here in the Burgenland, it comes in from the plain, over the plains from Hungary. And then down here in the Steiermark or Styria, you have the winds coming in, blowing in from Africa, from the Sahara, actually very hot winds, bringing in a lot of humidity and then raining down on the mountains here. Now, coming back to Stefan, the topography is, as I said, very flat rolling hills with a lot of wind, and actually so windy that one of the first things that you actually see when you leave the airport are the windmills. So you're constantly surrounded by windmills. So what this does, of course, this amount of wind in the vineyards is, of course, it dries the soil out. So we as producers have to understand one thing is that the wine is only made in the vineyard. This is extremely, extremely important. It cannot be made in the cellar where you press on a button and outcomes a great product. The moment the vines or the grapes are harvested, that is when everything has to be absolutely perfect. So the entire vintage until then has had to have been absolutely perfect to have the right quality for that wine, which means, especially in a region like here, you need water. We can't irrigate here. It's not like in California or in the rest of the New World where you can easily irrigate at free will. It is not allowed in Europe, period. So the only thing that retains water is humus in the soil. So if you have a very bare and let's say a barren soil without any humus, that soil will not produce really outstanding grapes because it's always dried. We saw this, for example, in 2013, as I mentioned, Stefan was awarded Best Grand Cru of Austria. Now, the irony of this was that he was awarded this award for his 2012 selection, which was a drought vintage. So I was in his vineyard 2 weeks before harvest. His vines of the Rotentürm that we will be tasting, oh, sorry, we're tasting wines. Sorry. which vintage should we taste first?
The 2018.
Great. Okay, thanks. So the Rotentürm, I'll tell you a little bit more about the vineyard later on, but at this moment, I just wanted to go back, get the attention back to what I was saying earlier. So we were walking through the vineyard. The vineyard stands on a fairly reddish soil, thus its name. And what happened was Stefan had pruned the vines twice that vintage. Although it was a drought vintage, the leaves were up towards the sun, like, give me more sun, give me more light, give me more, you know, I have all the energy to produce more photosynthesis. I want to produce good wine. The leaves looked healthy. There was no sign of stress on the leaves. His immediate neighbor, just exactly 2 meters next to him, The vines were drooping and sagging. They were looking like some plant that you had literally forgotten in the window and forgotten to water. So the point is, if once the vine goes into a stress mode, it will cut off all the nutrients to the grapes. Now we, as producers, of course, we have to make wine out of that. So we have to say, okay, well, you know, what do we do now? You know, at that point, you have to start becoming creative. So of course, you have to start adding things, but you don't actually need to do that if, of course, the entire vintage, the soil production, the entire production in the vineyards have been perfect. Now, what happens actually when you take a fertilizer or when you take herbicides or when you take pesticides? What actually happens is, especially with herbicides and fungicides especially, they drip down into the soil and they will destroy all the agents that are basically critical to producing humus. So over time, what's actually happening is that you're decreasing your amount of agents that are producing humus. It's not rocket science, you know? So there's, by the way, a very, very good movie on Netflix right now called Kiss the Ground that shows the interaction and how actually organic vineyards can also work as a sink for CO2, thus actually benefiting being beneficial to the climate crisis. So I think that's something extremely, extremely important to stress at this point. So let's go on to the next picture. And this is, I think it doesn't say anything better than this picture, is how organic matter builds up in this vineyard. So this is the Rotenpön. I think everybody should have it by now in the glass, I hope. So the Rotenpön once you open it, you have a very slight little bit of fizz coming. That means the wine still has its CO2 from the tank, which means it'll keep fresh longer. You can easily close it, put it back in the fridge and open it tomorrow and it'll still be very, very fresh, or even in 3 days. So what Stefan does here is so as I said earlier on, the vines are 45 years old. This means they have been under organic viticulture now for 30 years. So since 1990, they've been under organic viticulture. These two things, that the vines are 45 years old and they've been under organic viticulture for 35 years, is something completely unusual in the region, because what most producers do is that they'll tear up the vines after 20 years once the vine produces less and less and less. This is exactly the point where Stefan goes, yay, you know, the vine is producing less. We're getting much more concentration. We're getting much more minerality. We're getting length and more opulence. That's exactly perfect. That's exactly where he wants to be. Now, what Stefan does and what he really focuses on is to get a really good cover crop. So here, as you see, what he will do is he will bring in somewhere between 30 and 40 different types of cover crop, just to, first of all, really important to cover the ground. And then secondly, by doing that, to keep the ground cool. Thereby, the plants will not use all the acidity, and they will keep the acidity nice and balanced. So this is something I think that the Grüne Veltliner, especially the Rotenpön, exhibits beautifully. It's extremely well balanced. It has a lot of minerality. It has a lot of things going for it. And I'll come later to different types of food pairings, because I think especially Grüne Veltliner is one of the most versatile varieties there are. But I think this picture pretty much puts it all into focus that Stefan is really concentrated about the vigor of the soil. So that results in a good vigor of the vines, of course. Are there any questions so far? No, nothing? Okay. So just a couple of awards that he was awarded. I think some of the really nice ones are especially down here. So Stefan, early last year, was awarded Best Orange Wine of Austria. So he made an orange wine of Gewürztraminer and of Grüne Veltliner. And Gewürztraminer won the best orange wine. It's unfortunately not in the States yet. I'm just underscore on the yet, but we're working on it. So let's hope. I'm still talking to the importer. And his rosé was awarded pretty outlandish. I mean, that's amazing so far. It was really, really good. Really happy about the rosé on the top 12 of the Forbes list. So let's get cracking on. There are some more international awards if that is of any interest. Now we're coming to the food pairing. So this is what Grüne Veltliner can go very, very, very well with. I'll start in the top left corner. This is, of course, classical Viennese kitchen. Everybody knows a Wiener Schnitzel, so a veal schnitzel, not a pork schnitzel. You always drink Grüne Veltliner with a veal schnitzel. This is one of those funny pairings where people will always go like, what? This is actually meat. Why do you drink a white with this? This is actually the real thing. This is like if you were to go to Napoli in Italy and cut your spaghetti, you'd probably be kicked out. It's the same like here, you drink your Wiener Schnitzel with a glass of red, you get kicked out. So you always drink a Grüne Veltliner with your Wiener Schnitzel. Now, just imagine the entire Mediterranean, and let's start in Spain, for example, here with tapas, perfect pairing. All kinds of different tapas will go beautifully with Grüne Veltliner. Then we'll go to Italy, of course. So noodles, anything light, anything with, let's say, a chicken or anything, any braised fish, for example, it's beautiful. Then we'll go down here to Morocco. So a tagine, something with spices, with oranges. You can probably sense in the Grüne Veltliner, it also has a little bit of those different spices going on, maybe a little bit of oranges, a little bit of peaches, and a little bit of cream going on. I really, really like that. Then if you go over here to the left, that picture is supposed to stand for Pacific Rim. So anything Pacific Rim or let's say with a little bit of Asian influence, with Asian spices is absolutely perfect. Then in the middle, you have, of course, the real Asian food. So anything Vietnamese, Thai, even something like Japanese, of course, sushi is perfect with it. Then down here on the bottom right is Mexican, Tex-Mex, even that works. Here, something of course I forgot in the Mediterranean, that's anything Mezze from Israel or from Jordan. Olives, absolutely perfect. Now, that's the odd one out. The turkey does not go with Grüne Veltliner, as you can imagine, but it goes with the Zweigel that you have coming up next. So I'll just take the advantage and just go over to the Zweigel. Zweigel, if you could pour your glass with that, then I'll explain a little bit about Zweigel and about what is so beautiful about this variety. It's one of the, so Grüne Veltliner is the variety that is planted most in Austria. It's about 50% of all white varieties comes from Grüner Veltliner. Same for Zweigelt. So about 50% of all red varieties comes from Zweigelt. So Zweigelt was a variety that was crossed in the 1920s by a man called Zweigelt. And what he did was he crossed the three predominant varieties, Pinot Noir, Blaufränkisch, and Saint Laurent, and combined them into one variety that was very winter or frost resistant and had a good yield. So over the history, Zweigelt and Grüner Veltliner were used, especially after the war, were used to produce larger amounts or larger yields, thus giving wines of very little complexity, very little body, and very little ageability. So by, let's say, the 80s, by the 1980s, Grüner Veltliner and Zweigelt had become synonymous with very short living wines that don't age well. And this is completely false. If you take the varieties and you lower their yields, they'll produce very ageable, very, very well drinking wines, very balanced wines. And this is exactly what we're talking about here. So the Zweigelt that you have in front of you right now is definitely something that portrays a lot of, let's say, cherry aromas, a lot of herbs and a little bit of herbs and spices, so a little bit of white pepper and things like that. But what I personally really enjoy about it is that it doesn't come with a lot of tannin. So the back part of the wine is not tannic at all, which means you can easily chill it. I would recommend chilling the Zweigelt down to something like 13, 14 in Celsius. So that would be what, 60, 65, 60-ish, something like that. Now just think about, for example, having a barbecue during summer, and you don't want to have that big Californian red, of course, with the, you know, like the high amounts of alcohol. You want to have something a little bit more, you know, pleasant to drink. Take the Zweigelt. That's the whole idea. So the same also with a turkey dinner. It's light, it's refreshing. You want to have a second glass. You just want to go on and on and on. That's the whole idea about the Zweigelt. It's pretty simple. It's not a big wine, but it's a real good pleaser. Any questions so far?
I personally do have a question. Yeah. Is Zweigelt ever made in the same way as Gamay with the maceration techniques and the...
That's a great question. I always like to, for people who haven't had a Zweigelt before, I always like to say it's like a cross between a Gamay and a Tempranillo. You get a little bit of that lightness of a Gamay, and then you have that earthiness, the spiciness of a Tempranillo, and especially when you have a Zweigelt that is a little bit more on the heavier side with a little bit more alcohol, then that Tempranillo, that power comes out, of course, much, much more. Of course, not as much in a Tempranillo, but you always still have that little bit of a floral thing going on from the Gamay as well. Yeah. But there, to my knowledge, I haven't come across anybody doing a Maceración Carbonica on a Zweigelt, no. So next picture, this is another picture of one of Stefan's vineyards. Here again, you see that those kinds of rolling hills. It's a very beautiful landscape from my point of view. Here's a picture of the Rotenpön. So if you look at the soil right here, it's a little bit hard to tell, but especially when the vineyards are a little bit, and when the rain has just come down, you can see that the soils have that slightly reddish, that hint of red that I was referring to earlier. That shows that the soils are high in iron and phosphorus, which gives that orange peel taste, the slight the peach that is a little bit unusual for a Grüner Veltliner. So that makes this wine so unique because let's say the typical Grüner Veltliner would have aromas of apples, of cut grass, of white pepper, but the Rotenpöhn definitely portrays much, much more than that. So that, from my point of view, that comes mainly from the vineyard being or having been organic now for over 30 years, and that amount of humus that it builds up, that will help basically all the agents basically getting the aromas and from the soil into the grapes. That's what organics really does for you. So that's another picture of the Rotenpöhn again. And that is my last picture, pretty much.
Thank you so much. That's a whirlwind introduction to the winery. And I can imagine that there is quite a lot of manual labor that also goes into what Stefan does. Could you give us some insight on how that works for the winery and what techniques he uses? How long does harvest usually take using hand picking everything?
Thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. So his spray operations, he sprays mainly with a tractor and a recycling tunnel. So that what that means is these are pretty expensive and high maintenance sprays. So what happens is that the vine gets encapsulated by a huge tunnel, so that no spray can drift off into other vineyards, that all the sprays get reused in a tank. So on sprays, he'll use mainly sulfur in the beginning, and then he'll also move over to things like whey or something like kitchen soda or baking soda, because what that does is baking soda will raise the pH of the leaf. And especially funguses are very, very prone to having any kind of pH change. So they will die off immediately. Or something else that he uses is a silicium-based liquid that will strengthen the skin of the vines. That will make the funguses give them a hard time basically to actually penetrate the leaf, and thereby they will die off as well. So there are a variety of organic treatments that he can use. So sprays, he'll do the sprays mainly by himself, usually at night. So he'll get up like at 10 in the evening, having slept like 3 hours or something, and then work through the entire night, because that will allow the sprays to attach to the leaves much, much better than working during the heat in the day. The manual labor is usually taken care of with a small group of mainly Romanian workers who come every 3 months pretty much to take care of most jobs, and then go back home again and come back again. So harvest is carried out by hand, depending on the product, also by machines, but then very, very carefully and very, very precise. Then in the winery, what he does is he has a winery that works 100% with the gravity feed, which means he can work extremely well without getting too much tannins in from the skins. Thereby, he'll have a very, very small impact later of tannins at all in the resulting wine. Yeah. In the winery, he usually works mainly with steel, but there are also, of course, wines that go into wood, especially Grüne Veltliner. He'll easily put into wood. Sorry, but these wines are not available in the States yet. Again, we're working on it. So,
excellent. Well, we look forward to experiencing those wines when they are available. One last question before we say goodnight. Could you give us an idea of what the vintages have been for, if not specifically the region where Prash is, but Austria as a whole, over the last decade, over the last few years, to give us an idea of the consistency or if there's been an impact of climate change?
Well, there's definitely been an impact of climate change. There's no doubt about it. Again, Austria is divided into three sub-regions. If you take the Wachau as one region by itself, then it would be four sub-regions with different climate patterns. Again, so one region having, let's say, difficulties does not result in another one having difficulties. So like, let's say, for example, Steiermark had frost and snow after the buds had come out by this much, which is devastating. And so luckily in Stefan's region, in the Weinviertel in Niederösterreich, nothing had happened. So it's always a little bit tricky, of course. Yeah, I mean, I think the major impact that we have today is climate change. I mean, luckily enough, like, knock on wood, Stefan's dad, Willy, at the time in the late 80s, there was, of course, no sign of climate change. But today, the humus in the soil is the only thing that can buffer the impact of climate change. Or let's say we're talking about extreme drought and a lot of precipitation. And that precipitation, that water has to be stored somewhere. And so if we look at precipitation on the ground, we always have to think about two different types of runoff. So one, of course, is the runoff above the ground, but the other, that is of course much more important, is the runoff within the ground. And so if there's nothing within the ground to retain the water, that water is gone and goes into the groundwater. But with Stefan's soils, he's been able to capture all that water for a longer amount of time, and thereby, of course, building a bridge over a drought period. And those drought periods are becoming more and more or longer, and of course more intense as well. So it's a little bit hard to answer the question, but mainly because all the regions are so different. And the varieties that they grow are different in each corner. But yes, there is definitely an impact, and it's becoming more and more apparent. And so if anybody is really interested in producing quality now, he should really consider going organic.
Well, it sounds like Stefan is ahead of the cut, so to speak, in regards to reacting to climate change. Yeah. And I'm sure that, in your experience as a winemaker who has made wine on several continents, is the wine industry ahead of the cut as a whole, or is it playing catch up?
No, that's a good question. I mean, there are discussions in Europe. I mean, if you're looking at places like Bordeaux, they are putting the question out there: should we allow other varieties like a Syrah, for example, that can sustain a higher amount of heat, can we plant them, you know, under our AOC rules? That's, those questions are being asked, yes. So yes, the wine industry is playing catch up, definitely. And maybe within, probably in the next maybe 10 or 20 years, some wine regions will be facing some massive problems. I mean, there are places like, let's say, Denmark that are growing vines now, you know, of England, that's become a growing region. There are even vineyards in Sweden, you know. So
thank you very much. So let's see. Thank you for this incredible presentation and introduction to the estate. Jen, would you care to share any final thoughts before we say goodnight?
I think, as I said, if you take some time, go to the movie Kiss the Ground, I think that is a great introduction to what organics can actually really contribute to climate change. I think people have to become more aware about the impact that organic viticulture can do to help with climate change. And watching a movie like that is definitely a first step. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Jen. We appreciate your
time.
For those viewing, we appreciate your interest in the great wines of Austria. We encourage you to visit our website calendar, corkandfork.co, to view the upcoming Austrian wine events we are hosting with some of the region's greatest producers, such as our guest this evening. Again, thank you, Jen, and I wish you a lovely evening, and I'll be ending the meeting for all. So good night.
Thank you, Antoinette. Goodbye. Bye-bye.